to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. Michigan has been in the news a lot, and our whole
not for good things.
Not for good things.
Sorry,
and
Michigan.
So our episode is completely covering Michigan this
week. Our episode is Michigan from soup to nuts, and it's the Snyder Show.
It really is. And I think at the heart of it is this emergency manager system, right?
Yes.
So we've seen in Flint, we've talked about this before on the show, the emergency manager there is one of the reasons why the water is poisoned. But now we're also getting a lot of news stories about the Detroit public school system.
Well, and actually the emergency manager from Flint, who made the decisions that led to the water becoming poisoned, then headed over to Detroit and decided to be the emergency, or I should say got appointed by the state to be the emergency manager of the Detroit public school system, and has been a real success there, such that he has now also resigned because the schools are literally falling apart, as we will hear later in the episode.
Yeah, so it's a big trend. I actually just read a New York Times piece before I came in here talking about how people are getting more and more justifiably angry about these systems because it's essentially
emergency managers.
Yeah, emergency managers, because it's disenfranchising people. They're not having electeds that can be held accountable, and so we're seeing the ramifications of that in two very extreme ways.
So Kurt Guyette, a couple of weeks back, if you missed that episode, folks, check it out. He is the investigative reporter who broke the story of the Flint water crisis. If you missed it, it's definitely well worth going back and listening to. He described emergency managers as a system of austerity-driven autocracy. And I could not think of a better way
That's
to put it.
Amazing, yeah.
I'm super excited that sort of as a follow-up to that interview, we have on the pediatrician whom he referenced in that interview, who did a study herself of children's lead levels and showed that post poisoning from the water, the lead levels had doubled. And that was actually the study that caused the state officials to have to take action finally. Really excited to have her on the show this week, too.
Yeah, absolutely. That's, I think, one of my favorite interviews that we've done. She came by CAPS offices, so we actually got to sit down with her at a little round table and talk policy a bit, too.
With our lovely little handheld.
But we also have a great conversation with some folks on the ground in Detroit. We start out with Terrence Martin, who's the executive vice president of the Detroit Federation of Teachers. So he talks a bit about the lawsuit that they filed to hold the Detroit public school system accountable for the horrible conditions in the school system
and
there.
And the sick outs.
And the sick outs.
Which has been really something to behold. The teachers all calling out sick in coordinated fashion to protest the conditions of the schools.
Absolutely. And we get to hear from a teacher who's participated in that, Kim Mitchell, who's been a longtime teacher in the city. So we couldn't have a better episode, I think.
Go Michigan.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Tracy Ross.
And I'm Rebecca Vallis. On January 27th, the Detroit Federation of Teachers filed a lawsuit against the city's public school system, demanding repairs to deplorable school conditions, a plan to bring schools up to modern standards, and the removal of the state-appointed emergency manager who has been running the system. Incidentally, that emergency manager announced his resignation just this week. To discuss what's going on in the Detroit public school system, we're joined by Terrence Martin. He's the executive vice president for the Detroit Federation of Teachers. Terrence, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you for having me.
So before we get into the role of the Detroit Federation of Teachers, can you help us better understand what's going on in the Detroit public school system? What's going on with the conditions of schools there?
Well, you have a school district now in a urban area here in Detroit where its buildings are not up to code and not up to standard for teaching and learning. We have schools that half of the building does not have heat. We have schools where the heat is flowing so much that it's upwards to 90 degrees in classrooms, 95 degrees in classrooms, which makes it very difficult for teaching and learning to take place. We have buildings that need repairs on roof, floor, ceiling, and we also have a huge rodent infestation issue. And so these are the things that we have been forced to deal with here in Detroit.
So the sorts of things that you're describing, we have plenty of research and evidence that shows that this has a long-term impact on the health and cognitive ability of children, which makes all of this all the more pressing. But what are some of the immediate impacts to students that you've heard about?
Well, we've had students, there's a mold issue. And we know that with mold, students who have asthma or other upper respiratory issues, this affects them. So students are missing school because of these issues, because of the conditions of buildings. And so we know that it is important for a child to be in school every day. And when students miss school, then it affects their learning.
So the classrooms are quite literally not fit for students' health, and certainly not fit to be conducive to concentrating, to learning. Your union, the Detroit Federation of Teachers, recently filed a lawsuit against the city's public school system demanding repairs to the conditions that you've been describing. Tell us a little bit about that lawsuit and where it's headed.
Well, the lawsuit is was filed, and we're now in court waiting for the next step, actually waiting for an answer from the district at this point to how they plan to deal with this. And so we had no choice in filing this lawsuit. We have attempted many, many times to talk to the district. We have presented the district with some ideas in terms of resolution to these issues, but it has fallen on deaf ears. They've done nothing. And so the health, safety of our children, the health and safety of the nearly 4,000 folks that we service, the quality of education that the community deserves, was too big of an issue for us to ignore. We had to take some drastic steps, and filing this lawsuit was one of the ways that we're going to do it.
And one of the mechanisms in which teachers have been really pushing to defend children and to address the conditions of the school are through the what have been called sick outs, where their teachers are calling in sick to express their anger over these conditions. Can you describe what's been taking place on the ground?
So teachers have done these sick outs, rolling sick outs, where schools have been shut down for a day here or there. The last sick out that happened, over 80 schools in the 97 school district were shut down. And what it did was brought attention to these issues. Teachers have been yelling and screaming about these things for quite some time. And our cries are falling on deaf ears. And so what the sick outs did was bring about national, international attention to these issues that are happening in our school district.
And I imagine that this impacts families who are counting on being able to take their children to school that day, despite the fact that they're in horrible condition. What's your sense of how families have been reacting to the sick outs?
Well, I think that what families are realizing, parents are realizing, is that, hey, you know, we deserve better. The teachers want what's best for our children. And so these substandard conditions aren't okay. They aren't normal. And we want the same things that other, our neighboring school districts in suburban areas that are more wealthy have. We want the same opportunities for our children. And so they joined us in this fight. They're standing shoulder to shoulder with us now, saying, hey, we deserve better. We deserve better. We want better for our children. You know, schools are the backbone of the community. They are the stalwarts of our neighborhood. And we need to do everything that we can to maintain quality education for our children. We want our kids to have a chance in life. And that's what parents and community folks are saying, that the teachers are helping to provide an opportunity for my child and with their standing life with them.
Now, perhaps unsurprisingly, the school district has not been very pleased with the sick outs, and they actually have filed suit against your union, the Detroit Federation of Teachers, as well as other groups that have been involved. And they've been asking the court to stop what they're claiming are illegal strikes or illegal protests. how, I mean, is there any basis there, and how is that lawsuit that has been filed impacting your efforts and the union's efforts to hold the school district accountable for these substandard conditions?
Well, the district made a very poor attempt to file an injunction against teachers who performed, who participated in these sick outs. But what they did was really embarrassing themselves, because they filed lawsuits against about 23 of our teachers, many of whom were on approved medical leave of absence, many of whom were actually at work that day, many of whom were actually taking care of sick relative children, and had applied for leaves of absence at the time. So those folks, we believe very shortly here, are probably going to be exonerated. And the district is just another failed attempt to punish teachers and not really address the major issue. And it's not the teachers. It's the conditions of these buildings, and it's the type of quality education our students deserve.
And one of the dynamics at play here relates to the emergency manager system that Rebecca referred to at the top of this segment. And there's been plenty of conversations around Darnell Early in particular, since he was the emergency manager in Flint during the time that the decisions were made that have led to the current water crisis there. And now, Darnell Early recently resigned from being the emergency manager in your area of the school system. How is having someone who isn't being someone who can be held accountable impacting the way that the school system is ultimately run?
Well, it really takes away from the democratic process for the people. And right now, the people have no say in what happens in Detroit public schools. I mean, this law is draconian. It is a dictatorship, and you see the results of it in Flint with the water crisis, and now you're seeing the results of this law in Detroit public schools with the miseducation too, and the poor conditions of these buildings. One of the things that the lawsuit, we're hoping that the lawsuit does, is open up the book in DPS. We want to see where the money's been going, how it's been spent, and why hasn't it gotten to classrooms? And so, as you stated, you know, the same person who was the emergency manager in Flint is the emergency manager in DPS, and this is proven, they have proven, that the emergency manager laws do not work. Emergency management doesn't work. Restore local control to our citizens here in Detroit. Restore local control to the folks who are going to hold a leader, educational leader, accountable, and have the mechanism in place to do so, which doesn't exist right now. That's what needs to happen.
Now, just to play devil's advocate for a second, some of the critics of the sick outs and particularly of your union, you know, some of them are Republican legislators in your state, have been basically saying that local control is the problem, not the solution. And they point to the large amounts of debt that the school district finds itself in. There are estimates ranging from about $500 million to $1.5 billion, and that the school district is currently paying unsustainable payments each month just to maintain the level of debt that it has, not even digging out of the hole. How would you respond to people who make those allegations, and what do you think the real solution is here to help the school district get out of debt?
Well, I challenge those folks to look at the facts. The fact is that Detroit Public Schools has been under some form of emergency management since 1999. We only spent about a year and a half since 1999 not on emergency management, be it an appointed school board or be it an appointed financial manager or an appointed emergency manager by the state. Prior to emergency management or local control, there was a surplus in Detroit public schools. We were voted one of the most innovative school districts in the nation in those years. And so once emergency management came, once local control was taken from the people, that is when you saw the demise of our school districts. Now, today, over $515 million, of which state was in control of. The state signed off on those contracts. The state was responsible for the debt. The state should pay the debt. That's what I say those who challenged it.
And, you know, we've rightly been talking about how all of this is impacting students of the Detroit public school system, but obviously teachers are doing as much as they can in very horrible circumstances. What are some of the things that you're demanding specifically for the teachers? You know, what do the teachers need in order to better educate the students of Detroit?
Well, teachers need to be treated fairly and equitably for the jobs that they perform. And the way that they perform that job. You know, we have teachers in this district, the nearly 4,000 folks that I represent, who are the faithful few. You know, years ago, we were about 11,500. Now we're knocked down to about 4,000 folks. And those folks have loaned the district $50 million in 2009 to keep the doors open. Still haven't been paid back all that money. They're still a substantial amount of money that's still owed for us in regards to that. So these are the faithful few who do more with less. We don't have the supplies. We don't have the time to prepare lessons. We don't have the resources being poured into the classroom. So we're forced to make copies on our own. We're forced to provide supplies to students. Some of the basic needs of tissue, pencils, paper, things that children need and deserve in schools. Teachers are forced to provide those things for them on a very a minimal salary. And so what we're asking is for the state to pay the debt that they ran up, and for students for that money to be put into the classroom, into teaching and learning. And not for the huge salaries that administrators in this district are getting. As much as the district has a financial issue, it also has a priority issue. And their priorities haven't been in place. Money isn't being flowed. Resources aren't being flowed into the classroom. They're just not getting it.
As Tracy mentioned, just one last question while we still have you. Darnell Early, the state-appointed emergency manager, recently announced that he would be resigning. Are you and is the Detroit Federation of Teachers able to work with the state at all with regard to his replacement? Where do you see things going from here?
Well, I think that you know, one thing, the state has proven that emergency managers don't work. And so what we are hoping is that local control is returned to the school district. There's a bill in Lansing that will do that. And we believe that not only the teachers, but the citizens of Detroit deserve an opportunity to talk about the type of superintendent that they want in their schools. They deserve to be heard. They deserve to have a voice in choosing the educational leader that's going to take us out of emergency management and into a school district that we can all be proud of.
Terrence Martin.
And that's what we're hoping.
Terrence Martin, Executive Vice President for the Detroit Federation of Teachers in Michigan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Tracy Ross. To get another perspective about the situation in Detroit's public school system, we're joined by Kim Mitchell, a longtime teacher in the city. Welcome to the program, Kim.
Thank you.
So I understand that you've been teaching in the Detroit public school system for a while and that this was a deliberate choice for you. Why was it important for you to specifically teach in Detroit?
Well, I grew up in Detroit, and I decided after I graduated from college that I wanted to come back to the city where I grew up at and also where I lived. And I was also fortunate enough to be able to teach for 12 years in the same neighborhood that I grew up in. So that was very important to me.
And so the school that you taught in, the neighborhood, can you describe this area of the city for us?
The school that I initially taught in for 12 years was in on the border of Detroit. It was in a very small, it was a community-based school where everyone knew each other. Fourth, fifth, sixth generation of children went to the school, and pretty much that school, teachers stayed there until they retired. And then unfortunately, one day came along and an emergency manager, and they decided to close the school. They were in the neighborhood.
And so the lawsuit that the Detroit Federation of Teachers filed states a number of challenges that you as a teacher are facing and that students are facing, and one of them being that the schools are in deplorable conditions. I listened to a report that talked about rats and mold and these sorts of things. Can you describe, I guess, what it's like in the schools that you've been in, that you taught in personally and ones throughout the system?
Okay, well, I've been in some schools that were in very good condition, but what happens over time with DPS is they'll have brand new schools, but they don't maintain the buildings. So over time, you start having problems with heating, which is the biggest issue now. Either the classrooms are too hot, they're 80 and 90 degrees, or you have classrooms that are 40 and 50 degrees on a daily basis. There is issues with rodents, and it's common in a lot of areas to see rodents going across the classroom. As far as there's issues with water, there's lots of leaking pipes in a lot of the different schools. They have issues with the roofs. And a lot of times they've had contractors to come in and do work, but they're not holding them accountable for the work that they're doing.
We know that these sorts of problems can cause, you know, long-term impacts to students in terms of their health or their cognitive ability. But given that you're in the classroom with students on a daily basis, are there any immediate effects of just what these kinds of conditions have made on your students?
Well, we have a lot of children that have asthma. That is one of the biggest issues that we have. So for our asthmatic children, a lot of them have a very hard time breathing. As you were stating in the lawsuit, that DPS along with some of the, I'm sorry, DFT along with some of the parents have filed, is because of the fact that a lot of the parents, their children are falling ill and having asthma attacks at school because of the mold that's present in the building. And also the feces from the rodents.
And so without renovations and the sort of interventions that you need, what have you and other teachers and parents done to, in the meantime, to address these sorts of issues?
Most recently, there have been the sick outs that some teachers have participated in to state that they're not going to take this anymore. There are parents that have also been protesting the teachers. And believe it or not, you know, there have been many times where parents have come in and helped teachers to clean. You know, these are some of the things that the media doesn't see. You know, we work together. The teachers, a lot of times, they clean their own classrooms because custodial staff only works 5 hours a day, and they're expected to clean 20, 30 classrooms, and it's like four or five people. So all they're able to do is to dump trash and not even sweep the floors. So a lot of teachers are doing a lot on their own, and they're, you know, purchasing cleaning supplies for their classrooms. They're doing all these things on their own.
And you mentioned the sick outs. Can you describe what that is and what's been going on?
Basically, there have been three sick outs this school year where many teachers have participated because of the fact that a lot of them are sick. They're either sick because they actually have colds, asthma, things of that nature, or they're just sick and tired of the conditions that are in the building. They're sick and tired of not only themselves, but the children being sick. And they've gotten to a point where they can't work in the conditions that they're expected to work under and have the children come to school in those same conditions. So it wasn't just done for the teachers. It was done for the community.
So these were actually protest where teachers called in sick, essentially going on strike for the day.
Well, technically, it's a sick out. It is illegal to strike in the state of Michigan for teachers.
Important clarification. But so you all call in, and you said, you mentioned the parents are really getting behind the work that you're doing, since it's their children that are at risk. What do the parents think about the sick outs and the lawsuit itself?
A lot of the parents are supporting the sick outs. They said they understand why the teachers are doing it, because they also want to support us as well. They're looking for better for their children. And they figure it's time not only for the teachers to stand up, but also the community. And a lot of parents have started going along with the Detroit Federation of Teachers, our teachers union, to help us with actually going around canvassing the neighborhood, asking people for their support. So now we have community people that are also working with us. We're also going to have a walk-in where parents and community people will be able to walk through the schools and come and show their support, and that's also in the near future.
And I wanted to go back to the students. You mentioned them dealing with asthma attacks at school. Is there any particular story that you can recall that stands out in your mind of an instance that just you would want people to know, to understand just what you all are dealing with?
I haven't had any personally in my classroom, but last week during the press conference where they actually announced the lawsuit, there was a parent that actually was there, and she stated that her child recently had an asthma attack at school because of the mold. And then also Randy Weingarten, who is the American Federation of Teachers president, she did a walkthrough as well 2 weeks ago, and she said while she was there, she said she could, the air was so still, and it was also, you know, the mold that she could tell she started having a hard time breathing. So, you know, if you're not accustomed to being in a particular area on a day-to-day basis, you can definitely tell the difference.
And we're discussing a lot of the challenges, but obviously teachers are working around the clock to address this. And you mentioned before we started taping that there's a number of partnerships that you're forming. Can you talk about some of the organizations that you're working with to ensure that students in the schools are as strong as possible?
Well, at Detroit Public Schools, we do have Go Green, which is a recycling program that is co-sponsored with Detroit Edison. PNC Bank also works with our preschoolers. And then some of our schools, like we have a culinary arts school, we partner with Detroit Police Department, and we have a cadet program. There's robotics programs. We have chess, academic games. We also partner with the Detroit Institute of Arts, and the children's artwork a lot of times are displayed there, as well as the Detroit Library and the Charles Wright Museum of African-American History. So we have a lot of partnerships. There's a lot of people that work with the City of Detroit. We also have a lot of partnerships going along with Donor Shoes, where teachers are actually able to get the supplies and things they need through many grants.
And so a lot of news this week has been focused on Flint, Michigan, which is a neighbor of yours in the region. And people are, I guess, shocked about what is termed by scholars environmental racism, the fact that a community could be impacted in this way by having poisonous water, essentially. And I understand that you actually worked, the school that you worked in that closed was in the backyard of a refinery. And this is, it's so common to hear about these sorts of things, that communities of color and low-income communities are disproportionately cited near hazardous waste sites or industrial sites. From your experience, what was it like for that to be, the community that you were in was essentially a place where people and trash are discarded?
Well, actually, that same neighborhood is the neighborhood that I grew up in. The school that I worked at was actually in the refinery area, but they closed it down and put the children at a school that is less than a quarter mile away from the refinery. So all the soot, all the black smoke, the children, people in the community are inhaling that on a daily basis. That area, Detroit, has the highest asthma rate. people have been diagnosed with cancer more in that area than any other area of the city of Detroit. Smell, the stench is horrible, and DPS feels that the school that these children are currently in is the best place for them to be, which is sad.
Absolutely. It sounds like the work that you all are doing, staging these sick outs and essentially being part of this larger lawsuit, hopefully will shine more attention on this, especially as the country is realizing just how horrible these sorts of environmental racist policies and procedures in our communities are. You know, good luck to you and all the work that you're doing in the classroom and outside the classroom. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. A few weeks ago, we sat down with Kurt Guyette, the investigative reporter who broke the news on the Flint water crisis. As he mentioned, after traces of lead were discovered in the water, Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha helped sound the alarm through her own research that found that the number of children with elevated lead levels in their blood doubled since the changes to the Flint water system. To discuss this work, as well as the long road ahead for Flint, we're honored to be joined by Dr. Hannah Atisha, professor of pediatrics and human development at Michigan State University and director of the pediatric residency program at Hurley Medical Center. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So your study, along with a lot of the people on the ground in Flint, really helped raise awareness of the severity of the problem there. But can you explain exactly what it is that you looked into and how this data got released to the public?
Right. So as pediatricians, we routinely screen children for lead. We are mandated by Medicaid to screen children for lead at the ages of 1 and 2 years because Medicaid public insurance serves as a proxy for poverty. So kids who are poor in underserved communities have a higher risk of being exposed to lead because of lack of control of where they live, so poor housing stock and pre-existing poor nutrition. So we screen children for lead. And in late August of 2015, we were hearing reports that there was lead in the water. And whenever pediatricians hear about lead anywhere, it's a call to action. We know what lead does. We know of its life course damning consequences. So we were needed to figure out if that lead in the water was getting into the bodies of children. So all we did was look back at our records. As I said, we screened children for lead. So we went back and looked at the lead levels of children before the water switch in 2013, and we compared it to the lead levels of children after the water switch in 2015. The water switch happened in April of 2014. And what we saw, like you said, is that the percentage of children with lead poisoning in the entire city doubled. And in some neighborhoods, it actually tripled, and it directly correlated with where the water lead levels were the highest. And this was contrary to every trend we have seen in our nation, in our state, and in our city. We have done such a great job in public health getting rid of lead. We got lead out of paint. We got lead out of gas. We have home mitigation programs. So this was a complete shift in where we were going.
So we spoke a few weeks ago with Kurt Guyette, one mm-hmm. of the investigative reporters who was really instrumental mm-hmm. alongside mm-hmm. you in breaking this story and Absolutely. Bringing public attention mm-hmm. to the water crisis in Flint. You were recently named head of a new public health initiative to right. help children who have been exposed to lead. And we discussed a little bit with Kurt sort of your role in bringing this all to light. We discussed with him the denial by public officials right. That this was really a problem. And right. perhaps, you know, most visually, there was a press conference naming you to the position you were just named to. You're mm-hmm. actually standing with state officials, and you can be seen shaking your head no while those state officials are saying only 43 people have been contaminated right. with right. lead. Is the state still minimizing what's going on in Flint?
You know, I think they're finally owning this. I think they recognize that this was the governor's Katrina. He said that. So they are beginning the process of investing in the community because it's a long road ahead. So I am working with this governor, and I'm working with his staff, and I will need to work with him and probably the next five governors because this is a long-term problem. But I think there's finally kind of a shift, but it's just the beginning. There is a lot more resources and investment that needs to come in to mitigate this.
But I understand that when your study came out, there was pushback from
Absolutely.
The state, right?
There was that like? There was pushback for 18 months. So, the you know, right when this water switch happened, the moms were there, the activists there, the investigative journalists were there, the water experts were there, the pastors were there. It was all these concerns fell on deaf ears. And, you know, and when I released my research, you know, I was also attacked. You know, but then after, you know, a couple of weeks, they finally turned the corner.
But you were personally attacked. Your credibility yes. was actually besmirched.
Right. So I was called an unfortunate researcher, that I was causing near hysteria. But then finally, I had a good conversation with another physician at the state, another MD, MPH, somebody else with a public health background, who looked at their data and kind of was that game changer. But it was a continuation of the denial, deny, 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 deny. And fortunately or unfortunately, it took evidence that children were being poisoned. There were many missed opportunities. But now myself as a pediatrician who is charged with these care of these children, we need to focus on tomorrow. We need to focus on the resources and the interventions that these kids need now, because we are already 2 years too late. This started in April 2014. There is a two-year-old right now who's been drinking lead-tainted water for 2 years, and we have done nothing for them.
And so Rebecca mentioned that you've been appointed to this public health initiative.
Right.
Can you tell us what the plans are with this initiative?
Absolutely.
And again, it really was striking to see at this press conference them still trying to minimize the impact, saying it was only 43 people impacted
right.
by lead. It feels like this is going to be an uphill battle for you.
So this is a population-wide exposure. And I think, you know, every day there's something changes. But I think the state and the federal government now realize this is a population-wide exposure. Every child, every adult was potentially exposed and thus needs the interventions. So now I am directing this pediatric public health initiative. It's a partnership between Michigan State University, Hurley Children's Hospital, where I'm affiliated. So a Lane Grant University and a public academic hospital who've been in Flint for over 100 years, in partnership with community, in partnership with government. We are working with our local and state health departments as well. To flip the story, we want to become a model public health program. We are not going to sit back and in 20 years research these kids and see, you know, oh, here's some more statistics on the consequences of lead poisoning. We are going to throw every single thing at these kids right now to see how they're doing. We're also going to be continuing the research on how bad this exposure was. We have a lot of innovative research ongoing. We're going to do the long-term neurodevelopmental follow-up of this entire cohort, and then also advocating for and implementing these interventions and assessing them so we can show the nation as a best practice, look what we did, and this is what you can do if you have a similar situation.
And we're probably taking a little bit for granted that people understand the impacts of lead to young children. Can you describe just some of those immediate health impacts?
Yeah, so there really are no immediate health impacts. I love to trick my medical students. Like, how does a kid with lead poisoning present? They'll be like, headache, stomach ache. Well, no, nothing. They present with nothing. And that's why we screen them. This is a problem of tomorrow. So in 3 to 5 years, we're going to have more kids with learning disabilities. In, 5 to 7 years, we're going to have more kids with behavior problems. You know, in a decade, there's going to be criminal justice problems if we do nothing. So lead is an irreversible, potent neurotoxin. It impacts your cognition, actually drops your IQ. So imagine what we have done to potentially to an entire population. We have shifted that IQ curve down, and it impacts your behavior. It causes attention deficit, focusing issues, impulsivity, conduct disorder. And as I said, it's been linked to criminality. And there's also a multi-generational impact of lead. Moms exposed to lead, you can see the DNA changes in their grandchildren. So it has these life course, multi-generational impacts, which is why the CDC and the American Academy of Pediatrics say repeatedly, there is no safe level of lead. It should never be in the body of a child, because even at low levels, you can see some of these consequences.
So, you know, talking about the irreversible mm-hmm. consequences of exposure to lead, particularly in childhood, the country is paying attention now, right, as it should be. And thankfully, there's finally the level of really uproar that is deserved in this situation. But I'm probably not alone in being skeptical about mm-hmm. how long this concern is going to last.
Right.
And these children, as they grow up into adults who faced lead exposure in childhood, they're not going to be any less in need of support and intervention 10 years from now, is what you're saying.
Yep.
What kinds of policies do we need to see people talking about and putting in place
to
help these kids have a chance?
That's what we need right now. So we need an investment in education. We need universal preschool. We need early literacy programs. We need school health services, and we have none of those. We need an investment in nutrition. We have no full-service grocery store in Flint. We need access to nutrition. We need nutrition resources both in the short term and in the long term. We need health resources, behavioral health resources, pushing kids to their medical home. This is not something for pop-up medical clinics. This is all about long-term follow-up. So there are things that can be done in the policy level, such as funding of Head Start, preschool programs, such as WIC, expanding WIC eligibility. Many of these interventions that can be funded to help our kids now. And like I said, it needs to happen now, because it is 2 years too late.
There was a state official in the Snyder administration who was actually quoted, it came out a mm-hmm. few weeks ago, as sort of saying to a parent, well, don't worry, it's just going to knock a few points off your kid's IQ. It's not that big a deal. Do you have faith that policymakers in the state of Michigan are going to take the steps you just outlined?
Well, this is a community that has kept everybody accountable. This community has not kept quiet, from the journalists to the activists to the moms, now to the physicians. So we are keeping everybody accountable. So we are grateful for the declarations and the apologies and the bills that are coming through, but we will keep everybody accountable until we see those resources on the ground.
And so this week you testified before the Democratic Steering and Policy Committee about the situation in Flint and many of the issues that you just outlined. But we've seen that lawmakers on the floor of Congress are really dragging their feet about doing the right thing, about how the federal government can play a significant role in what's going on. What do you think that federal leaders should be doing?
Yeah, so this is not a partisan issue. This is like an oil spill or a flood or a radiation exposure. We have a clearly demarcated area where an entire population was exposed to a neurotoxin. Okay, so we need the same robust federal response that we've seen for all these other emergencies. This may not be, a natural disaster. This is a man-made disaster, but we need the same effort, the same investment. But even more importantly, we need that view of the long term. So yeah, a flood, you clean it up, it's better. There's no immediate cleanup here. We need the recognition that this is a long-term investment. So we need all parties to recognize this and to build this American city. This Flint, Michigan put the world on wheels. We are the birthplace of the UAW. We have so much resilience and pride, and our community is empowered, and they are going to get through this, but we cannot get through this alone.
Now, it's something that's received a lot of attention, as it should, throughout the discussion of the Flint water crisis, is the fact that the city is majority Black, right, that it has 40% of its residents mm-hmm. living below the federal poverty level. That's nearly three times the national average, and that this would not have been allowed to happen had Flint not had that demographic profile. Mm-hmm. But of course, Flint is far from alone, and my co-host Tracy has written extensively about this, that environmental racism is something that persists across this country, even in 2016. Mm-hmm. What do we need to be doing as a nation to not just raise awareness, but to reverse the fact that, as Tracy often says, racism is in the air we breathe?
Yeah, this is, it's well known that lead is an environmental injustice, and it's often been called environmental racism because it disproportionately affects our low-income minority children. Before this, even before this, kids in inner city, predominantly minority communities, are exposed to lead and other injustices. And this is, the city was almost with these poor kids. I mean, their only fault was that they lived in an almost bankrupt city that lost control of city governance, that decided to change their water to save money, and they didn't treat it properly. So it's their fault that they have now these lifelong potential consequences because of, policy decisions. It continues the story of the poor being treated poorly. And, it would never have gone on this long if it was a community that had more political clout. Those voices that had been raising their voices for 18 months would have been heard a lot earlier. So it's unfortunate.
And you alluded to the state emergency management system that's going on. And we talked in this episode to teachers and union leaders in Detroit who now are dealing with Darnell Early, who's the state-appointed emergency manager in Flint. He recently resigned from Detroit. How do you feel like the system that is set up in place is going to impact the work that you're doing with other activists and community leaders?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of work to do. We're hopeful that the city can regain some of its governing abilities. That seems to be coming to fruit. But there's a lot of work to do to rebuild the city, to bring their voice, to allow their voices to be heard again, because they have, really essentially been neglected, not just for these last 2 years, but for decades. It's been decades of disinvestment and kind of lack of any attention to these kind of communities.
And I think one important thing, before I know we're pressed for time or we're going to have to let you go shortly, is that we've had people write in asking, well, what can we do to support what's happening in Flint? How do you feel like people outside of the community can contribute? And what do you want people to understand, since, as Rebecca pointed out, this is an issue that its time has come, the media is paying attention, but that might not be the case.
Yeah, so keep talking about Flint. Keep talking about it. You guys are doing a great job. We would be nowhere without the media, people like Kirk Ayette, who brought this up, and the investigative journalists. So keep talking about Flint. And then, help us invest in our children. So we have a fund called flintkids.org. We are grateful to the world for giving us water and filters and water and water and water. And thank you. But we don't need any more water. We can't store any more water. The feds are paying for water, so don't pay for it. But help us invest in tomorrow. Help us provide the interventions that our children need now, the early literacy programs, the nutrition services, all these things that we can do now so that we don't see those consequences. Because these children need to be invested in just like any other child in this country.
Thank you so much for your leadership in raising awareness about this and forcing state officials to do their jobs. And thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha is the professor of pediatrics and human development at Michigan State University. She's also the director of the pediatric residency program at the Hurley Medical Center. And she played a crucial role in sounding the alarm through her own research about the Flint water crisis.
Thank you.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross, and it's time for the Weekly Worst.
Is that the way that we introduce the segment now? Or are you going to sing
for it? For now. I might have a better way.
For this week?
For this week. I'm the Weekly Worst.
Weekly song this week.
Okay, you're making my song sound good. But as always,
I'm the one on Cap's karaoke team.
Oh, that's
Let
true.
Let the record reflect.
That is true, and I'm a groupie, though. We'll get into that. I feel like Alan's feeling left out. Alan Pike is in the studio.
Yeah, is Alan here with us, Tracy?
Yeah, I have a quick question. Where can people come and see the Cap karaoke team in action?
Mondays at Mackey's at 18th and L Northwest, DC residents. There is no live stream. You have to
put that on the air.
I was gonna say non-DC residents.
All right.
There's no live stream, but DC people, we'd love to see you come out.
All right. So we've got another installment of the Weekly Worst where Alan shares three stories related to poverty and we vote on which is the worst one. But you want to start with a caveat, right?
Yes. We're hedging. Let's just stipulate that what's going on still in Flint, Michigan, with poisoned water that is so poisoned that it qualifies as toxic waste under EPA guidelines,
as people heard earlier in the episode, yet
right.
again,
continues to be pretty obviously the worst thing that's happening to poor Americans. The worst single story that you could single out. But to try to shake up the candidacy here, we're gonna stipulate that Flint's terrible and bring you three other things to argue about.
So basically, we're rebranding the Weekly Worst, the Weekly Worst that is not Flint.
Yeah, the Weekly Second Worst.
The Weekly Second Worst.
All right. So what's the first story?
The Weekly's still pretty darn bad.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. First up, Tennessee has found just 65 confirmed drug users out of nearly 40,000 people who applied for welfare benefits in the state over the past year and a half. The state only drug tests applicants who answer yes to at least one of three questions on a questionnaire about their personal involvement with illegal drugs. But still, that means that 609 people have been forced to pee in a cup for the volunteer state, and only 65 tested positive. It's about 10.7% of everybody who actually took a drug test, but it's less than 0.25% of everybody who applied for these benefits, which, by the way, average about $165 a month.
So I want to get back to the important piece of that in just a second. But first off, I had no idea that Tennessee was the volunteer state. Is that a thing?
I had to look it up. I thought it was called Rocky Top. But I think that's the song about Tennessee.
Okay, moving back.
But that's really a thing? You didn't make that up.
Did you like that wordplay? The volunteer state is forcing people to pee in a cup?
That was clever.
No, I didn't even, I like that right over my head.
All right, so you threw out a lot of numbers, but at the end of the day, the story is that...
Oh, you're trying to have a serious conversation.
Yeah, guys, come on, work with me. That they're requiring people to go through drug testing for a very small amount of money, and we're not yielding really high results at all. We're not seeing very many drug users
amongst
this.
We've started to see a number of states take up policies like this in the last couple of years. A couple tried to make it mandatory across the board for all applicants, and they've been told that's unconstitutional. So they've gone to this sort of two-stage screening process like Tennessee has, where anyone who applies, included in the application is this short questionnaire. Do you use drugs? Have you ever been convicted of a crime involving drugs? And I think the third is, have you had a court date for a drug offense in the last 3 months or something like that? It's a very specific couple of questions. The idea is just, if any of these is a yes, that's going to pop, and we're going to make you pee in a cup.
Right.
But of course, we don't make, say, rich people pay in a cup for all of their benefits that they get through the tax code.
Did you
say
pay in a cup?
Pee in a cup.
Okay.
Did I say pay in a cup?
You did.
Maybe.
Should I claim that as wordplay?
I was like,
that was
like
just like what
somehow.
Alan did. Yeah. It was wordplay. We also don't make corporations pee or pay in a cup for their corporate welfare. And also drug use among the public assistance populations is like lower than the general population. So over the drug testing stuff, it costs more than it saves.
Right. And it's just treating stigmatizing an entire population of people.
Yes.
What's your next story?
All right. School kids in Harford County, Maryland are not going to be taking any field trips to Baltimore for the foreseeable future. It's because the Harford County School District has banned teachers from taking kids on trips into the city, citing concerns related to the unrest over the trials of six Baltimore cops accused of killing
Freddie
Gray last year.
Holy cow.
Other suburban Maryland schools have started to return to Charm City since then, but Harford County, which, and this is going to shock you, is 80% white.
I was waiting for that. Sorry, America. But
I thought you were
going to
say 80% racist. Because maybe it's that too.
I don't know if we have good census data on... on per capita racism, but we do know that Harford County...
Can you find that out for us for the next episode?
Sure. Thanks. Harford County is 80% white, and it's going to keep all of its kids away from Baltimore, which is 63% black.
So they can't go to the National Aquarium. They can't go to the museums that are there. They
also
can't...
a great train station. Baltimore Penn Station, yeah. One of my favorites.
I really
isn't
like
there
Baltimore.
Like an Edgar Allan Poe? Isn't Poe a Baltimore guy? Aren't there
really?
Like...
So I mean, there's a lot of historical things that young children would be mm-hmm. able to see in Baltimore that's incredibly awesome.
And also, let's not neglect the educational value of seeing like actual black people
right.
in the wild.
Exactly.
Like people,
oh,
people
in their natural habitat.
Forgive the phrasing
to.
Of that in the wild, but
I'm
but
saying,
your actual
though,
point is completely
I know,
correct.
I know exposure to different experiences is not like a silver bullet for racism, but I also know that one of the reasons that I'm probably tangibly less racist than your average white person is that I grew up in a pretty diverse place and that my parents made it a point to expose us to communities that didn't necessarily look
right.
like us.
Right.
You
and
heard
Alan
it here
Pike.
First.
Less
I
racist.
Was literally about to do that.
Oh,
less
we had a mind.
Let's do it together.
Okay.
Alan Pike.
Less
racist than your average white person.
Anyway, story three. I just let you finish that. Story three.
All right.
You did. You held me out of my own there.
So Uber drivers have seen their earnings collapse by as much as half since the company slashed its prices for riders in January. Obviously good for people who use Uber on the rider end, bad for people who drive for Uber on the other end. And they've started to get some backlash for this already. There's been a rally and a strike, although I don't know how you go on strike from Uber since you work whenever you want, but whatever.
There was a rally
in New York City at the start of February to protest these changes. And according to an informal survey of drivers done by coworker.org, as many as 60% may be considering quitting driving for Uber, and 18% of the people who responded to the survey said they've already quit driving for Uber. And my colleague Lauren Williams at Think Progress talked to one woman named Tanya Forrester, who drives in Tampa, who said that she's been struggling to pull in even $350 a week while driving full-time, and that she used to make $700 or $800 a week working roughly the same schedule. And she told Lauren, quote, "If I had the honor and privilege to get a normal job, I would."
So we only have a couple minutes since we took a lot of liberties with this segment to just make fun of each other.
One way to, well, mostly Alan.
Mostly Alan, that's true. So people-wise, Alan was our weekly worst. But story-wise, I'm going to go and vote with the Uber story, actually, even though I think I had a more visceral reaction to the school children avoiding Baltimore. And I think it's maybe because I don't necessarily want to single that out because I feel like stuff like that happens with a lot of school systems across the country. But with it, when it comes to Uber, Uber's a company that is trying to be part of the new economy. People are really excited about the models that they've set up. And they've just consistently done some pretty poor decisions when it comes to their workers. Their CEO is a piece of work. I'm voting for that one.
So I, even though it's not new, even though it's something that may happen in school districts and workplaces and environments all over the country, I have to vote for the Baltimore one because it's horrible. And to Alan's point, right, if we're basically the logical conclusion of that is that everyone is going to grow up in their own little bubble of what's in a 2-mile radius and they're right. only going to see people who look like them. They're only going to meet people who look like them. They're only going to be in an echo chamber of of certain experiences and levels of income and race and opinion, et cetera. And that's not a world that I want to live in.
Absolutely. I support your vote. Alan?
Yeah, I'm voting for Harford County, Maryland, too, mostly because, like you were just saying, if all you see of people whose experiences and both their own in their own lifetimes and what they grew up, the stories they grew up hearing are radically different from yours, if all you see of people who don't look like you and didn't grow up like you is those who make it onto television, either, you know, TV, movies, entertainment, or because they're on the 11 o'clock news.
Or reality television.
Sure, right. Then you're on the fast track to being one of those people who's pretty sure they can't be racist because they've got that one black friend at work.
You just looked at me, Rebecca. Well, also because I looked over at you. But
just to be clear.
I'm not her only black friend at work.
Tracy is not all my black friend.
Yeah, there we go.
To be clear.
And look how bad we're doing at talking about racism. And we're pretty good at
kids,
this.
Kids, don't be like us, but be better.
And they're going to be even worse.
Yeah. Well, it warms my heart that my two white weekly worst colleagues on this.
I thought you were going to say your two white friends.
No, my two white friends on this Black History Month episode. Obviously, we have multiple. Are making sure that the white kids of this county are being exposed. So thank you for those votes. You guys won.
On that note,
did you just accuse us of exposing children?
Alan, I don't want to know. I don't want to know where that goes. I want to know which one won. I think it was ours.
It was you guys. That's what I was just saying.
Yeah.
It was my
I wanted
victory
to get back
speech
to that.
And praise for you too.
The casual, tacit, isolationist racism of Harford County, Maryland has won.
That's a hashtag if ever
works.
I've heard one.
All right. Thanks, on that note. Alan. And we'll be back with Alan next week for another installment of the
Maybe.
Weekly Wars.
Yes,
maybe.
Thanks.
Potentially.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us weekends at 11 a.m. on the We Act Radio Network. You can also catch us Saturdays, 11 a.m., and Sundays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Voices Network via the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. And feel free to pitch us on Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org. See you next week.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring in the dough. And none of those could connect me with the HMO. And nowadays it's common for grandparents to outlive their grandkids. And those are the type of odds that we handling. I'm not a slave to a man with a whip. I'm a slave to the U.S. men. And they got me doing things in my life that never made any